for tuning in to the Medevac Podcast, powered by the Robert Irvine Foundation, whose mission is to support and strengthen the physical and mental well-being of our nation's heroes and their families. I'm one of your hosts, David Reed.
And I'm your other host, Christian Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Medevac Podcast. If you're new here, you're getting a challenge. You have to share this with a friend or family member or leave a review at the end. It takes like 2 seconds to leave a review, so just hit the button, listen through, and let us know what you really think. Our guest today is Nate Cavender. He is a former C-17 pilot in the Air Force. He is an entrepreneur now and a representative or ambassador with Carry the Load Foundation.
That's right.
So thanks for joining us today, Nate.
Thanks for being on.
Of course. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you.
That's great. Well, obviously, it sounds to me like you have a lot going on, especially when we talked a little bit before the show. But let's rewind it way back to the beginning and talk about what inspired you to join the military.
Yeah. So everybody knows where they were September 11th, mm-hmm. I think, right?
Yeah.
So I was a senior in high school, and I remember, you know, that morning when we started to learn what happened, and I had this anger / patriotism well up inside of me, mm-hmm. and I knew right then I wanted to do something about it. But I also was thinking, hey, I really want to make sure I go to college too. So that year I started applying to all the services to see if I could get a scholarship, because I was going to go to college and then, you know, do the ROTC thing and mm-hmm. then join. So got a scholarship, a 4-year scholarship with the Air Force. And then I was like, well, hell, if I'm going to be in the Air Force, might as well fly some airplanes.
Yeah.
So I got lucky enough to get a pilot slot out of college and then commissioned in 2006.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What were you hoping to fly?
Initially, I think I really wanted to fly A-10s.
Mm-hmm. The bad boys.
Yeah, the bad boys. And I actually got stationed, when I was on casual waiting to go to pilot training, I got stationed in Tucson where they had base.
Yeah, Davis-Monthan.
Davis-Monthan. Yeah. And I saw him there. But it ended up working out, you know, with C-17s, and got to do a lot of cool things, see a lot of cool things.
Yeah.
So
it's a lot of good travel, right?
It was a lot of travel.
I think C-17 pilot or C-17 loadmaster, some of the best jobs in the Air Force.
I agree. We got to, we didn't necessarily always sleep in tents. We were sometimes in some pretty nice locations.
Oh, yeah.
With some beaches and nice hotels.
And the airplane breaks. Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly.
What I love about the Air Force, man, is like truly, like every branch is like, see the world, you know? And then Army is like, see the desert. And the Air Force is like, see the best resorts you've ever seen in your life.
Get good at golf.
Yeah. You're never going to do your job because the planes are always broken.
I'm not going to lie. There were several times when we didn't have a critical mission coming up. You know, if we had a crew chief flying with us, and those are the guys that fix the aircraft, if we needed them to, we'd like, you know, if you can't fix that today, we won't be mad at you.
Do you need to order parts?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's 2 days? Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of that training you're going through and like how it starts, right? We've all kind of heard the story is you don't know what plane you're getting assigned and all that stuff. But you're going into this like, I'm going to be an A-10 pilot?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it just kind of...
I think you... Honestly, when I went... Yes, a little bit. But you also really don't know... You don't even have a clue what you're getting yourself into. I mean, it's probably true with a lot of different jobs in the military. But pilot training is one big kick in the ass. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's... it feels like you are... doing a 4-year degree in about 1 year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're young, you're coming straight out of college. I mean, I was in a fraternity, loved to have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And so those good times kind of go away cause you don't have time for them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, you go into this not really realizing how hard it's going to be. And then you don't realize what you're really good at. Cause that kind of, points you in the right direction of what aircraft you're going to end up flying or what you like. Right. But it was a really good experience that I'd never want to do again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And what, like obviously the tempo, the amount of material that you're putting in, what was the things that really interested you and you found your skill sets in?
Well, first, you know, at first you're just trying to hang on. But then once you start talking to the instructor pilots, and a lot of them flew other weapon systems before they came back to the schoolhouse, right? So you start finding the personalities that kind of fit you. Mm-hmm. And there was this one instructor that I was like, you know, I just had a good relationship with him, and he's kind of the type of guy I like to hang out with. And I asked him, you know, what did he fly? He actually did fly 17s, and he just started telling me, you know, you are gonna travel a lot, you are gonna stay in some of those nice locations, but you're also gonna be able to do some really cool, meaningful things like medevacs. Mm-hmm. You're gonna be able to, you know, do some DV support. You know, I flew around Obama's helicopters a few times, you know, or so you get to do a lot of different stuff. And it wasn't just one type of mission, right? So, and then also I like the fact that you're, even when you're home, you're still having an impact. It's not just when you're deployed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and then I started to realize I was really good at doing a lot of things at one time, and I enjoyed having a crew. So, you know, having another pilot with mm-hmm. me or working with other folks. So I think that's what drew me into crew aircraft.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And that's a big difference. I was on helicopters. Obviously, it's very, very tight crews and very crew intensive. But we'd have fighter pilots come over, or, you know, bomber pilots come over, single pilot aircraft. And working with a crew then, it's night and day difference to them. They have no idea what's going on. Like, why am I listening to this enlisted guy? Tell me what to do.
Exactly. And you know, when people always ask the question, you know, what do you miss the most?
Yeah.
It's honestly the crew, like being on the road, being a crew dog. Mm-hmm. You're 20 something years old. You have no idea where you're going or what your mission is going to be the next 2 weeks, but you know, you're going to be gone for 2 weeks. And you're going to do something that's worth it, worthwhile. I miss that the most.
Yeah, you get to fly a big-ass airplane to other countries with your friends.
Exactly.
It's great.
Exactly. And get paid to do it.
Yeah, exactly, at the same time. Well, that's awesome. So you make it through all your training. You get selected for C-17s. Anything out of the ordinary during that training, or is it relatively straightforward for you?
There was a point where the washout rate in pilot training is relatively high. I mean, I think it's somewhere around 40%, 30 to 40%.
Yeah.
There was a point, everybody goes through this, where you have maybe a check ride that doesn't go well.
Sure. Yeah.
And you feel like, oh man,
that's it for me.
Yeah. I'm not going to make it. At first I was having some air sickness, and the instructor pilot thought it would be fun one day. It was like my third or fourth sortie, and he knew I was having air sickness, and it was a little bit of a hazing moment, but he started rocking the wings back and forth, just showing me the pattern. And on landing, I was getting ready to let it loose. And he's like, dude, you got to put your mask back on, or, you know, we're not gonna be able to land. So I didn't want him to know what happened. So in the mask, and then had to get rid of it. Without him knowing. So you can imagine what I had to do. And so it was because I was scared to get kicked out of pilot training.
Sure,
so I think that was a low point for me.
That's not the worst thing that could ever happen.
Yeah, but it was pretty low.
Did you get over that?
I did.
Okay.
Actually, after that, I was over it.
Your body was like, never again.
Don't do that.
Yeah. What were you flying at the time?
It was a T-6.
Okay.
So, I mean, they're fully acrobatic, but, you know, it's your sensory overload those first few sorties.
Absolutely, you're
flipping up, you know, a lot of motion going on.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. On purpose.
That was brutal. Yeah. But there was a few, you know, I had like a check ride that didn't go well. And then so you go to another flight that's to evaluate should they kick you out or not. Mm-hmm. And so during that flight, your nerves are really high because, you know, you're putting everything that you've ever done and wished for and hoped for into this pilot training, and you want to be successful. So it was a little stressful at that moment. But other than that, it went well.
Okay. So you make it through, you get your C-17 training, and where's your first duty station?
McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. That's where I was probably the most busy, flew the most. You mm-hmm. know, as a co-pilot, they kick your butt.
Oh, yeah.
So I bet I was gone 200 something days a year, easy, for mm-hmm. those first 3 years. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
And what do you love about the C-17?
Man, so it's a large aircraft, mm-hmm. But kind of what I was talking about earlier, it can do so many things. You know, it can do, you know, we can put an Abrams tank in there and take it in wherever it needs to go, but we can also do medevacs. We can do airdrop to, you know, whatever's going on. So I think the versatility of it, but also it was super, it was overpowered, so we could come in steep and leave steep, mm-hmm. to get out of the weapons engagement zone. Mm-hmm. And it flew, it had a stick and a HUD, so it flew like a fighter. I mean, it maneuvered really well, and mm-hmm. it had a lot of power. One of the really cool things that I don't know if you guys ever flew on a 17, but...
Oh, yeah, I jumped out of 17.
Okay. Did you ever do... like one of the really steep descents, mm-hmm. we could throw the
combat landings.
Yeah, okay.
Combat takeoffs. Absolutely.
That was fun.
And it's crazy to me because like I fly all the time now for work commercial, and you know, the slightest turbulence, people are like, I'm like, no, dude, this plane is way more capable than you could ever imagine.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
And the safety parameters that they put on for commercial flying.
No doubt.
Yeah. This thing could flip upside down if it wanted to.
Yeah. It really could.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, but
you might drop a few, you know, yeah. 10,000 feet or so.
Probably. Yeah. My favorite thing was to throw those, the engines in reverse idle in flight and, you know, initially get that 20,000 negative VVI. And I mean, everything in the down. Plane yeah. just float to the top, you know.
Yeah.
It's like negative, I don't remember how many G's we would have, but it was fun.
Yeah, that's like the vomit comet, right?
Yeah.
You know, they go and they stall out the airplane, so you're floating in the back for whatever, 30, 40 seconds.
Yep.
Yeah.
You get that. A few times we scared the air traffic controller. I remember coming back into Turkey. We were supposed to tell them we were doing that, but sometimes we forget because we were going into the base, and the base would clear, you know, ATC would clear us there. But the Turkish controllers would come on the radio like, are you, because we're falling out of the sky. They just see our our altitude just quickly disappearing, and they're like, are you okay? You know, reach whatever. Are you fine? Oh, yeah, sorry, we're good.
That's funny. Yeah. Are you falling out of the sky? Yeah. Like, yeah, it's on purpose, though. Yeah. So.
Yep, that was a good time.
So what are some other crazy things that people don't think the 17 is capable of?
I mean, the short field landings, mm-hmm. I think for a plane that big, you could, you know, we could land an airplane within 3,500 feet, which for people that don't know, that's, you know, a normal runway at a, you know, a commercial airport's probably 10, 13,000 feet. Yeah. So we could land it in the first quarter, or first fifth,
yeah,
easily, right? So I think that's probably pretty impressive. And then take off in that same mm-hmm. amount of runway.
Yeah, fully
to loaded. See a plane that big do that's pretty impressive.
It is, yeah. What was your mission set flying out of McGuire? Did you guys have a specific mission set, or was it more variable?
We did some of that DV lift because mm-hmm. we're so close to DC.
Sure, yeah.
But we did, we were mostly... Out of McGuire, we were mostly transport, so we didn't have an airdrop mission out of McGuire. Mm-hmm. So we actually got a fair share of medevac missions out of there as well.
Okay.
So everything from DV lift, which is kind of the one end of the spectrum, to, you know, medevac lift, and then everything in between, running to, we were both kind of in Afghanistan and Iraq at mm-hmm. that time, so... You never knew where you were going to end up when you left mm-hmm. left station.
Yeah, so for the medevac missions, it's primarily patient transport, I would imagine, from...
Yeah, a lot of times it was, you know, we'd drop into Bagram or Kandahar
yeah.
and get guys to Germany, you
yeah.
know, Launchstuhl, so they
yeah.
could get the...
I've been on that flight.
And that's not for the guys that we were carrying, obviously, but for us, sometimes it was a nice break, right, from the desert. Because
yeah.
usually we get to stay the night in Germany.
Which yeah.
I think everybody liked that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Have a night off from the desert.
Yeah. Get some good food. Maybe yeah. have a couple drinks.
It was not comfortable in the back of that thing on the way home, though, I will say.
Get cold?
Well, it's like the three stacked bunks that you have.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember I was in the middle bunk, and both legs are just torn up. My back's broken. And I had to pee. Like, and I could not go. I'm not getting up out of this
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way I'm stuck here. So for like 17 hours, I'm sitting there. Just
oh my gosh. They did have a, like for the guys that were jumping, did they let you, there was like little holes in the back you mm-hmm. could pee basically in the side of the aircraft. Did
I couldn't even get out of that bed though. I couldn't even, I was stuck in that thing.
That's awful.
It was awful. It was an awful.
Were you just denying the catheter the whole time?
I did. I said, you're not putting that thing in me for sure. I'm not taking the catheter, dude.
Dang.
Should have taken the catheter.
I
don't know how you made that.
Well, I was on so many drugs.
Okay.
That even when I got there, they're like, you need to pee because you're about to explode, literally. And I would sit there and try. Literally sit there and try. And they're like,
it's not.
They're like, if you don't go this time, we will have to put a catheter in. And sure as shit, this took me like 45 minutes.
Just face red.
But all that, if people don't realize all that pain medication that you're taking is like, it shuts everything down almost. So you're just constantly frozen.
That's awful. But you could feel the urge and the pain.
I mean, my stomach was distended. Oh my God. You know? Yeah.
Because you probably got IVs in too, right?
You got IVs in. Constantly. Yeah. So now you got constant fluids too. So it's just
I can't even imagine that.
It was brutal. This is the worst.
So I probably shouldn't complain about, you know, the nasty bathroom.
Getting a day
situation.
In Germany. Yeah. I was like, that's nice. Yeah, for you.
Yeah. No, that's why I was like, my whole not life for the guys that were not for the guys in the back. But.
I know. I'm just messing with you.
That's the two sides of medevac though, right? Yeah.
It's
just another day.
Just another day. We had a guy, like we did this reconnection episode a few months back, and we had this elaborate story of this guy's, his experience being rescued, you know, and being injured in the field. And then the story from the medic side was just like, yeah, man, don't really remember much of the day. It just seemed pretty normal.
Yeah.
So you get that, like, someone's worst day of their life. And then just another day on the job, right? And that's it for you too.
Yeah, actually, so it's one of my stories that I tell, and I kind of, you know, I'm a part of Carry the Load. One of the stories that I tell is one of the reasons that I think Carry the Load means so much to me was a realization that I had on a mission like that, what you're talking about. It was like my third mission, and We got called in to drop in. We didn't know we were going to be doing medevac, but we were flying over Bagram, and we got called in that a guy needed to get to Germany quickly. Mm-hmm. So we dropped in, and you know, I'm a new co-pilot, so all I'm worried about at that point is like, I want to be a good co-pilot so I get, you know, make aircraft commander, then instructor pilot, and all the things, and career guy, whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I jump down, I see the medical team bringing the soldier on. They're working on him. And my job, I gotta, you know, do a walk around, make sure we don't have any bullet holes, make sure we're getting gas, you know, make sure there's nothing wrong with the airplane, all that. So I go do my job, and I come back onto the aircraft, and I look over, they're still working on the guy, and I see his face. I'm probably at the time 24, 25 years old. Mm-hmm. I see his face, and he's 18, 19 years old, young kid. Mm-hmm. And then I look down a little further, and I see that he's missing everything from the waist down. And for a second, it kind of hit me like, oh shit, this is real. This mm-hmm. is serious. But then I got back into the mode of, okay, be a good co-pilot. Let's get up in the cockpit. Let's get to Germany. And then that night when I went to bed, I was kind of like really upset with myself because I didn't even take the time to ask his name. I didn't know anything about him. And to this day, it's my biggest regret of my service is that, you know, I don't know anything about him. And I would love to, if there was ever an opportunity to reach out to him or his family and just say thank you, you know, I would. Mm-hmm. So
did you ever try to track down the flight and information?
I looked when I started, I didn't really start talking about that until after I got out. So this is in 2015. That was probably around 2011.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I looked back at everything was paper.
Yeah.
And I looked back at all my, I think we call them, I can't even remember the form number now, like 937s or 731s. I think it was 731s, where you have, you log your time and who was on the flight, and it's just crew. The pilots never kept record of what we actually carried.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The PAX manifest.
And I don't even think that ever really got logged anywhere that
should,
I know
it
about.
It should be fine. So not to get too technical with, it's going to bore people, but your ARMS, so Aviation Resource Management. So we have people in the Air Force who manage your Air Force and your flying paperwork, basically. So you should be able to call an Air Force historian, which there are historians in every branch of service. They're really easy to get a hold of, but it'll take you like 6 months to get the data. They'll go in, they'll pull the ARMS paperwork from like a certain date range, or if you can give them a specific date.
Yeah.
They can tail number. You guys are good.
Yeah, so I... The other thing is, I would have to do so.
Just a date range.
It's good to hear that because I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they'll give you the PAX manifest.
That's awesome. So I'll have to probably, because all I see are, I know where we landed, because I can't remember what exact date it was. Right.
Sure.
A range. I remember a range of time and a range of missions.
Yeah,
I'd have to do a few, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the whole premise of what we're trying to do on this show as well. Is there's so much closure in that reconnection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many people, so many times, including the people who rescued me, you know, I don't know them, you know, and that would be great closure to be like, what the fuck did I say on that with all that ketamine?
Yeah, right.
Purple elephants. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that is incredible to hear. I'm going to have to go back and do that now.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be great if you were able to get reconnected with them.
Yeah.
And there's also, oddly enough, right, there was about 1,500 amputees of all of GWAT.
Wow.
1,500. So of those that are hip artics, like it sounds like he was, mm-hmm. there's not many.
Yeah.
There's probably like 3 or 4 out there.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So... That's another thing too. Is I think you could definitely track it down if you needed to.
I think I'm going to, because it would be good to tell him, thanks.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And just see what, maybe even strike up a relationship. I would love that actually. But yeah, I mean that's what Carry the Load's all about, is just being thankful. For, you know, mm-hmm. fast forward. I'm maybe 5 years or so. I'm an instructor pilot now. I've got my own crew. And we're doing an angel flight, so it's for the guys that paid the ultimate sacrifice, and we get to, I think it was Kandahar, and we pick up a soldier. They bring him on in the casket, and you know it's customary for people that don't know, for units, if they can, to send back somebody to escort the body to the family. And so usually it's a close friend of the individual. And so, this case, they did send somebody, and, he, as you were talking about, I think, well, the C-17 is very cold at, altitude. It's a metal floor for those that don't know. And, he laid down on that floor next to the casket, and the loadmaster, you know, we're doing a combat takeoff out of Kandahar, obviously. And he's like, should we tell him to get in the seat? And I'm like, no, just let him yeah. stay there. And so when we got up to cruise, I told the co-pilot, you know, your aircraft went downstairs. Yes, there were stairs in the C-17. went downstairs, brought him a blanket, and I asked him, you know, about, you know, what his friend's name was. And so I could say thank you to him and, you know, tell that story. And so now, you know, and I carry Sergeant Peterson's name with me, and now all of you carry his name. Mm-hmm. And in Carry the Load, there's Memorial March, and we have an event here in Dallas where there's an all-night walk on Katy Trail, mm-hmm. and people are telling those stories. And every time you tell somebody's story, now they carry that story with them, mm-hmm. and they
carry
can
the
continue.
Load.
They carry the load. And not only are you carrying the stories and the memories and the sacrifices of those people, but you're also carrying people that they left behind, mm-hmm. right? Because it's not only about remembering what they did for us, but it's also about carrying the loved ones that they left behind.
Mm. Yeah, that's fantastic.
It's an awesome organization.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. How did you get involved with them?
When I got out in 15, I was I was kind of, I mean, I think everybody has their own story when they get out and they struggle with things, right? Yeah. I was struggling with being, feeling like I wasn't a part of something that...
Identity?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I wanted an organization that was giving back and...
So
and
purpose, drive, right. All that stuff. Exactly. The same common things.
Yeah.
And yeah, talk about that before you get into carry the load, right. As well as how you felt right when you're exiting out. I mean, that's a hard career to give up. Why mm-hmm. give right. that up?
Yeah. Well, I was really, there's a lot of air crew feel, I think. I was really beat down and tired, mm-hmm. worn out. I was gone, like I said, like 200 something days a year, usually.
For 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah,
and flying just,
yeah.
A lot of it had to be boring as well.
Cruise, it gets boring. Yeah. And there's like those moments of terror, and then it's a lot of boredom.
Yeah.
So I just decided, and I was married and wanted to have a family, and it just being gone in the airlines, I had interviews with American and Southwest, you know.
Okay.
And then I'm sitting there with the instructor pilot. I got my 737 type rating, and he's like, congratulations, you know, you're going to have a great time in your career. And I asked him, I said, well, why don't you fly anymore? You know, he's just a simulator instructor. He said, man, be honest, I woke up one day in a hotel. I didn't know what city I was in. I missed my family. And I'm like, well, shit. I mean, I'm doing that already.
You're terrible at recruiting. Yeah.
And not to mention, like, you're just getting Bob to his meeting on time in Chicago. Like, I don't care about that at all. So
you're a glorified taxi service at the end of the day. That's what a lot of, like, old ex-military, like, veteran pilots say when I talk to them. They're like, it's like living, you know, you've lived all your glory in the past, and with this career, it doesn't feel that way anymore.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah. So it just, exactly. And it wasn't for me. So, but I think the biggest challenge, you know, getting out at first, you're struggling with, you were the badass at what you were doing by the time you get out usually, right? You're really good and people respected you for it. Then when you get out, especially when you change career fields like I did, you know nothing. You're bottom of the totem pole. So you take a bit of a hit to your ego first. Mm-hmm.
And then ego is pretty prominent in pilots.
Yeah, it, from time to time.
I'm a pilot.
Oh, you couldn't tell when I walked in?
Yeah. You can tell by your Randolphs.
Yeah. My instructor pilot used to tell me, you know, the only thing you got to do to be a good pilot is look good and sound good on the radio. Yeah. But yeah, so it was tough starting a new career, and then it was really hard for me just trying to figure out what to wear every day, having to actually think about that.
Yeah.
And then realizing what I was wearing didn't make sense when I looked around the room, like, dang, I've got to work on this. So that took me a while.
Dressed like the parachute pants from the early 2000s.
Well, like, and just my, like, the button-ups that just hung off you know, not tailored at all.
Yeah.
I was in dire straits.
Affliction t-shirt. Yeah.
So many military guys wore Affliction.
I know.
And I'm guilty.
Well, somehow they struck a deal with, like, Infantry Basic where they, like, would sell all these Affliction tap-out shirts right upon graduating. So you just spend your entire paycheck for basic training on these stupid shirts.
And stuff, yeah.
I'm a fighter. That's it, like, that was the thing. But anyway, so you're it's the accountability, right? Is that transitioning out of the military, all of a sudden you go from this, like, it's just intense schedule to now no one gives a fuck where you are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And oh, by the way, you don't know really how much you're going to make, and what you're starting to get paid right now is probably less than you were making in the military. Yeah. So
no healthcare.
Yeah. It was a rude awakening. Mm-hmm. And then just not knowing what the future holds, right? Like, in the military, you know what a career path looks like. Yeah. You know what you're going to make. And you know, if you do well, what will happen. You don't know that at all when you get out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it's a little scary.
Yeah.
So I think that, for me, it was just the unknown was the hardest part for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, how about, like, mental health-wise? How are you feeling there? Are you integrating really well back into the civilian world or struggling?
I think at first the ego was – I mean, I was very lucky, right? So thank you for your sacrifice, by the way. But
I appreciate
it. I never – I mean, being in a cockpit most of the time, you're in a controlled environment. Mm-hmm. So my mental, you know, most pilots, you know, I know there's a lot of situations that could affect your mental health that we go through, but in a controlled environment, we don't have the same mental stresses, I think, as a lot of other folks in the military. So I felt like when I came out, I was probably in a better place than a lot of Good. Other guys. Mm. But there was some things that I struggled with, you know, some of those stories, like one I just shared with you. I mean, that affects you in ways. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of it, too, was like you're trying to figure out if this guy that you're working with at wherever you're working has your back, like the guy that was your loadmaster on this mission. And that... And they, in the civilian world, they don't necessarily always have your back.
I don't think, I think for most people, they don't have your back in the civilian world. It's more about themselves and their progression. Mm-hmm. And they're willing to step on the backs of anyone to get that done. And listen, I'm definitely not saying everybody out there like that. But in the corporate environment, it certainly is. It's everybody for themselves, mm-hmm. right? You have your hierarchy, but I'm trying to get to that, you know, get to that position. And I don't care about my left and right.
That's
a problem. You know, as a leader in the military, you want to see that, you know, that person underneath you successful. So you cultivate. And then mentorship is a prominent thing in the military. And you don't necessarily have that. And it's like, it's not worth my time. I don't get paid to help you out.
No doubt.
And it's more transactional.
Yeah. And I experienced that a little in the beginning, so that made it a little rough. Mm-hmm. But then luckily found some mentors after that. I think that can really hinder anyone getting out of the military if somebody doesn't really have their back right off the bat. Mm-hmm. It could really change the way their relationships are and, mm-hmm. and their ability to be successful. You know, I think it's critical. So there's a lot of organizations out there that help guys when they're getting out, and I think they're doing good work.
They are.
Yeah.
They are. And the military is starting to do a better job as well. Like SkillBridge, we talk about SkillBridge. Right. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful program. And I think that has helped. The people that we've talked about who've been in that program has integrated way easier into society again.
That's awesome.
Because you're in 6 months of both worlds, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. A little bit of it. And I think that's a huge help. And you hit something right on the head, too, is... It's the who you surround yourself with when you get out of the military, because if you're isolated, alone, or you know have a bad batch of friends, you're right back into that pattern.
No doubt.
Or you're in solitude, mm-hmm. and that's not good either.
Especially if you're dealing with the mental health.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And two, like imagine you, you know, getting out of the military, not having a family, and all this stuff, going back to your home, no accountability, no one cares if you're there at formation anymore. And then you have those feelings as well. Like my greatest regret is not talking to that kid and, you know, on the 17, and you just are in this loop over and over again. And then 10 years has passed and you can't get over it. I think that's the compounding effects. Mm-hmm. We got to chip away slowly. And doing that by integrating SkillBridge was such.
I love to hear that.
And, yeah.
Cause I hate hearing the guys that feel that loneliness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They just need. And that's why I want to reach out to that guy. You know, I hope he's not there. Mm-hmm. I hope he has people, and definitely want to be that person for him. Hopefully soon.
Hopefully he's that guy. I forget his name, who does the Spartan races.
Oh yeah,
he's a hipartic.
Yeah,
and this guy like handstands the entire race. Yeah.
Like runs on his hands.
How crazy would that be?
That I'd love that.
Yeah.
He'd probably beat me.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing, too, is, the resilience that the military instills as well is you went through all this pilot training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was so difficult, so hard. You wanted it so much. You have that to always look back and fall back on.
Right.
And apply that into the world that you're going in. And how do you use what you learned in the military, hone those skills to create what you're doing now?
Yeah. Well, I think... as a pilot, you get good at being multitasking and also figuring things out that you might not have been trained on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we got trained to fly a specific airplane, but we weren't necessarily trained to figure out specific problems that were going on in the squadron or or, you know, be a good, you know, we did have some leadership classes, but you really don't learn that stuff until you get out in the real world. Yeah. Right. So I think, you know, the fact that I loved being able to multitask and do a lot of different things. And I think that that applied into what I'm doing now. You know, I basically have three jobs. So,
yeah.
I think that I took some of that, and a lot of officers, I think, not just pilots, though, are expected in the military, officers and NCOs, are expected to learn things that they weren't necessarily trained on and then get good at it. Mm-hmm. And I think the military does that well for a lot of folks.
Yeah.
So you can go out into the world and just figure something out.
Yeah. Learn how to learn, right?
Yeah.
It's really important. And on the same aspect, I do want to double down on the SkillBridge program.
Yeah.
Or if you are not pursuing a SkillBridge, finding a community before leaving the military, right? Mm-hmm. Being able to cross those.
Yeah, that's super important.
Have a foot on both sides of the line before you make your exit. It's going to help you, you know, be prepared and set yourself up for success in the future.
Like, have a goal. Mm-hmm. Of what do you want to do? You
know? Well, people crash and burn when they have no sense of community again. I mean, that's a countless. We've had about 150 interviews at this point, and almost everybody says the same thing. It's that accountability and loss of tribe, which leads to a loss of purpose and mission, essentially, at the end of the day. So that's what I always implore people when they get out, is take that 6 months to dip your toes into something that interests you while maintaining, you know, a sense of community and, you know, surrounding yourself with like-minded individuals. You have to do it.
Yeah.
Right. Otherwise, like I said, that isolation occurs, those deep, dark thoughts, right? If half the time we have those internal conversations, they're much more extreme than when we have someone else to just, like, find equilibrium with. There's a balance to that.
Yeah. Yep. And I that's probably what pushed me to join, you know, to find something like Carry the Load. Have that.
And that's smart.
Thank goodness. Yeah. And I'm glad there's a lot of organizations to plug into.
Yeah. You realized that it was your responsibility to seek it out.
Right.
That's a lot of thing that people miss is, or, you know, they don't realize when they're getting out. In the military, you have your community and you're there inherently, right? You have no responsibility other than to show up along with everyone else. And there's your community. All you have to do is show up. Not the same once you get out. It's your responsibility to find it or create it, you know, seek it out. It's not just going to show up at your door every day.
And most of the time they're telling you will show up and do this at this time with these people.
Yeah. Yep. So all you have to do is listen and you have your community.
Yeah.
Yeah. And another salient characteristic I would say is that, you know, officers, NCOs, have a tendency to do a little bit better when they get out. Right. We're not talking the compounding 10 plus deployers, right? Those guys hit a certain level and it's just damage. Mm-hmm. Damage is done. But when you have the ability to sit outside of the scope of yourself and understand that I'm leading other people, you have a tendency to take care of yourself a little bit better. Yeah. So the E4s and below really struggle with transition. Especially, I mean, officer types, right? You get a plethora of resources that the average enlisted man doesn't get as well. I mean, they make exceptions for officers too. We're going to hold you. We're going to hold your retirement, hold your medical retirement until you get your hip replaced, right? We've had that. That was yesterday's show, right?
Wow.
So, because he was a colonel. But then you have people that sneeze wrong and then you're like, you're out, So I think that's the thing, is we need to start treating people as people again before they get out a certain stint.
Yeah. Not to mention, you know, the NCOs and officers also have a lot more specialized training, which makes it easier on them to get a job or transition into a community than it does for, you know, E3s, E4s.
True story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So most of the time these, you know, E3s, E2s, whatever, are going right back into the situation without thinking about it. They get their letter out, they're out of the military, they go back, surround themselves with those former friends, or they're not around anymore, and they get into trouble or just right back in the same flow. Right.
Mm-hmm. With their dark thoughts sometimes.
Yeah. And inherent alcoholism, because it's a majority percentage, unfortunately, that struggle with alcoholism upon getting out.
Yeah.
Especially in that range, you know, that E3, E4 range.
But it's so common.
Yeah. But it's part of the community. It's part of the culture, unfortunately.
I'm not aware of a, and I'm sure there is an organization that focuses on specifically like addiction, like alcohol,
substance abuse.
There's tons of them out there. As a matter of fact.
And I'm sure Carry the Load even supports a few, I feel bad.
Well, a big thing that organizations do is there'll be specific clinics that have veteran programs. Mm-hmm. And that's a big one is fundraising's a little difficult because you have these organizations. I mean, they reach out to us at the foundation all the time and they ask for like, hey, can we put this resource up? And we do on our website have quite a bit of resources for those that are going through substance abuse and, you know, trying to overcome alcoholism, that kind of thing. But for the most part, they're a part of a bigger and larger entity.
Right.
But as far as like a mission focused veteran group only out there, I couldn't name one off the top of my head. You're right on that.
Yeah.
But also, you don't think it's a problem. Like, I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol until, you know, when I'm every single weekend I'm drinking and, you know, couple drinks a week. I was like, that's normal to me. Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know,
well, it's almost a little bit of a culture too, you know,
it is for us
as veterans.
What do you do when you get off a flight?
Right.
You go out to dinner and you get some drinks.
Well, you know, unless you're in one of those, spots where they didn't have, did you ever go to the like Kyrgyzstan or Manas where you get two drinks?
Yeah.
The number nines.
Yeah. R&O.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, as long as you had enough time off, definitely get a drink. And if you went to Germany, you'd have quite a few.
Oh yeah.
It's part of the culture.
Yeah. It's part of the culture.
Yeah.
Hard to break that when you get out, for sure.
It was for sure. It's for sure hard to break. And I think it's hard to break because it's so ingrained in our society as well. I mean, that alcohol is associated with celebration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and it's like the one thing that you do, if you tell people, and this happens to Christian all the time, I don't drink, they look at you like, what's wrong with you? You have a problem?
I tell people like, I just don't like drinking anymore. Like, it's not that I had a major issue with alcohol or Alcoholics Anonymous or anything. I just don't drink anymore. I don't like it. And I always get that like, oh, you had a problem.
Yeah.
What's wrong with, why don't you drink? It's always,
I switched to heroin.
Yeah. It's like, I just don't like it. Yeah. Like, it's always baffling to people. I don't get it. Or I get shit for it sometimes. Like, oh, you don't drink, pussy.
Especially, like, I guess. If you were to try to do that while you were in.
I drank while I was in.
You'll be upside down on a tree, duct tape there, and someone's got
a hose in your
mouth.
Yeah. A hose of vodka. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's literally what they do before you go to Ranger school. Like,
are you serious?
And regiment. Yeah.
Like, they heard about
force you to drink and leave you for like 24 hours strapped to a tree.
I just heard about I think it might have been your podcast, one of your podcasts that I was listening to, The Best Ranger.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds insane.
Best Ranger competition.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, our company, Terra Arma, supports it. I think we're the only.
So we're the base layer sponsor for them and the media sponsor. So we do all the video and stuff for them through our company, Terra Arma. But we're actually out there next week.
Awesome.
Best Ranger is next week in Georgia.
I can't make that, but next year I want to try to come see that.
Yeah, April. It'll probably be the past by the time this airs.
But, yeah.
It was 3 weeks ago. Yeah. I don't know when this is going live.
Yeah, we are currently in April. Yeah, it's coming up here shortly. But I mean, did you ever go to Best Ranger when you were a Ranger?
Oh, I never competed. Mm-hmm. I never competed, but of course, it's really instilled into the culture there. And it's now like the last, I don't know how many years, don't quote me on it, but is open to all of anyone who has a Ranger tab. So mm-hmm. Ranger qualified last year, 82nd won. So nice. Hopefully this year, Ranger Regiment will take that stick back.
Awesome.
You know?
Yeah, my stepdad was a Ranger back in the Vietnam time frame. Or right after Vietnam. I wonder if he's heard of that. He'd probably like to go see that.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I need to take him down there and see. Where do they do it?
They do it at Fort Moore.
Okay.
Fort Moore.
Previously Benning.
Yeah. Fort Benning. I don't know if I can call it Benning. It just gets makes me sick to say that because that's where I went to basic at was Fort Benning,
okay.
Georgia, and this new name change they're doing for everything else. It just seems so unnecessary.
I couldn't even tell you probably some of the Air Force bases now, the changes that they're making. I don't even understand what's happening.
I don't think anyone does.
Yeah,
the simulation's just glitching.
Yeah.
What are we doing today? Let's just rename all the
stuff.
Yeah. Let's rename the stuff. I swear that's how it works. Like, you know, we had this running joke. We used to do these, like, kind of make the privates do skits, you know.
And I love that.
Yeah, it's just the silliest thing, no demand as well. But, you know, one of the skits, they have this huge map of Afghanistan up. And, a guy comes out. He shaved his head to look like the commander. He comes out with a pillow under his stomach. And he's like, all right, what are we ripping out to tonight? And he takes a dart and throws it on the wall. And he's like, yeah, that looks about right. And we just lose our minds because we're like, that's what's happening back in the top.
No, you got nothing.
And then you go out there and it's just, you walked 8 clicks for nothing.
Yeah, what?
To see, yeah, Mud Hut, you know.
Bad intel. Sorry,
Did
boys.
You guys used to, because I'm sure those were long, you know, you'd be tired, maybe at night, right?
Oh, yeah.
Did you guys have rippets?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I know a private, one of our privates, filled his camelback up with rippets. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to be hard charging. Heat cat out. We had to exfil him out.
I was going to ask, like, how bad were those for you? Because we used to, on missions, sometimes try to, I mean, we're young kids, but we would try to see who could drink the most rippets.
Yeah, absolutely.
Six or seven, I had shaking.
Two cases always under my bed.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, I'd wake up in the morning, crack one. I probably have, like, six to eight a day.
Yeah.
With wash it down with those strawberry Pop Tarts that are nuclear.
100% took years off our life with Rippets.
That's gains right there.
Though. Rippets and Pop Tarts.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm just thinking about we used to get these meals on our, like, from the flight kitchen, and they were these sandwiches that were
the hoagies.
Yeah, but the like there was like maybe a thin, small couple slices of meat, and the rest of it was this disgusting bread.
Gross bread. Yeah.
I mean, it's all soggy too. They're always soggy. Like, and they somehow wondered, they got wet.
Something would always spill on your bread. Yeah. And why was the air crew always like a little chubby after a deployment? It's because all we ate was
bread.
Massive amounts of bread.
Sandwiches.
And chips and ribbons.
And also, yeah, exactly. I have been looking for years to find that same saran wrap.
Oh, yeah.
It smells so bad.
It smells bad. It's also like the stickiest.
That's hilarious.
Like, yeah.
I can visualize it right now. That saran wrap is awful.
Extra thin saran wrap.
Stinky. You know, never hated saran wrap so much.
If you got a bag of Lay's potato chip, plain potato chips, and like that shit cookie. Have you ever gotten that?
Yeah.
We're like, I'm a cookie monster myself, man. I'll eat them all up. But that one, I was like, it's like cardboard. They just 3D printed that thing. You know?
3D printed
a single chocolate chip.
I got to the point where I was actually eating MREs because I preferred that over the flight kitchen meals, which is pretty
I did the
awful
same thing.
To say.
I rough. Did the same thing because those were, and especially like when the new MREs came out, you got like cheese tort
those
with
are nice.
M&Ms.
What was the, was it like beef?
Beef stew?
Enchilada. Oh, beef stew.
I
think there was an enchilada one. It was a little spicy. That
beef
was my
enchilada.
Jam. Yeah.
Christian's favorite is the veggie omelet.
Oh, I did not like that one. I did not like that.
I'll take them all day.
Oh.
Veggie omelet.
So gross.
Yeah, I'll
so
take
gross.
Them all day.
Oh, man.
I always lucked out. Everyone's like, oh, God, I hate this one. I'm like, I'll take three or four.
Yeah,
thank you.
Just stuff those under your bed.
Yeah.
Something isn't right with eating an omelet that's been stuffed somewhere.
And it looks like rubber.
Yeah,
but I would trade that entire main meal of just for like the packet of peanut butter.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'd be like, here you go.
Yeah. Jalapeno cheese.
No doubt.
On the rations bread that you would get in like Auschwitz.
Yeah, the 600 calorie cracker.
You know what I mean?
I used to try to get
it's like it's just chalk, like
Those do you know how they had the little coffee like
little packet
of coffee grounds.
Yeah,
I would in the airplane, it was hard to make coffee. So I would always ask people, give me your coffee. And I would just
put it in like a dip.
Dip them.
Yeah.
And that helped on those long night flights a lot.
Yeah.
When we ran out of Rippets.
Yeah. The Rippets.
It's in between Rippets.
Yeah. In between Rippets, get a little
coffee dip.
Yeah.
So, like, let's talk. I love the conversations on that too, but no, it's fantastic. But let's talk about kind of the tools that you were able to obtain in the military and how you apply that in your leadership of all the things that you have going on now.
Yeah. You know, I think again, you know, going back to the, you know, just learning things,
multitasking,
learning things that you weren't necessarily trained for, and just figuring out how to make it work.
Yeah, okay. Learning to learn.
Yeah. Right.
But also I think it's important to note is like the years of sleep deprivation and constant cramming and all of that information overload. It's got to be to a point where you're multitasking now and you're like, I could handle a lot more than I used to be able to because I'm used to having such a heavy load.
Right. No doubt. I mean, and it, you layer in family, and I have a 5-year-old daughter now. So the sleep deprivation was real there for a little while, as anybody with kids knows. But yeah, I think also you realize when there's, you know, when you start having problems with, you know, I've got a small business, a little concrete restoration company called the Driveway Company. When you're starting a business, there's a lot of stress that goes into that.
Oh, yeah.
And things go wrong. But you always remember, like, hey, this, you know, I think back to those stories that I was telling earlier, like, this is not that bad.
Yeah, and I say all the time, it's like, hey, you know, when it's going tough, I'm stressed. And I'll remind myself and others, you're not getting shot at.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it can be a lot worse.
It's not life and death. And it's funny, like nowadays I look and when I see urgent, like people all cap an urgent email or immediate response, like I'll open it up like, okay, you know, someone's gone down here. Who are going to?
Yeah.
What's going on?
And it's,
someone didn't empty the shredder. Like,
there was a typo on the last social media post. Urgent. It said Taylor instead of Tyler.
Yeah. No, it that has helped me a ton, honestly. It's because, you know, with my own business, but also in the corporate world, I work now for WebMD Health Services. I do B2B sales for them, their wellness platform. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there can be a lot of, like you were just talking about, overreaction to things.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to understand and focus on what matters, I think that's been one of the things that's helped me be successful in the corporate world.
So in other words, like prioritization as well is understanding the importance of some tasks, not necessarily in order, but things are going to be jumped around.
Yeah, and that it's going to be, at the end of the day,
it's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay.
We'll survive.
Yeah.
And survive. One of the great things too about the, you know, working with WebMD, they do, you know, going back to some of the mental health stuff we were talking about, you know, I get a lot of sense of purpose with working there because we do provide programs to employees that may not be veterans, but they do struggle with health issues or mental health, you know, which is part of health.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that you have an opportunity to really make an impact on people's lives. So it's been fun to have another sense of purpose besides, you know, carry the load. There's also, hey, we're doing some good work over here as well, you know?
And I think filling your time up with that, you know, those passion projects that become something bigger or, you know, being involved in selflessly serving, right? That's such a fundamental, you know, innate belief that every service member has now.
Right.
It's instilled upon them to be a part of something much bigger than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have like carry the load and now you're helping with, you know, people find the right health platforms they need for their, their companies to thrive. I mean, that's rewarding work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I honestly, you know, I urge any veteran out there that's feeling lost or lonely to look for not only if you're looking for a job or just looking for an organization to belong to, look for something that you can feel like you're serving again. Because I feel like initially all of us had some sort of that. We were in a voluntary service, right? So all of us, for the most part, had a calling to serve. And so if you've lost that, there's a lot of opportunity out there. You just got to look. Just got to open your eyes.
Beautiful.
Yeah. You have to take the responsibility to you know, make the decision to do
it. Don't. Your first sergeant's not going to tell you where to go this time.
True story.
Yeah.
True story.
Yeah. Sounds good. Well, hey, Nate, we really appreciate you you coming on today, you sharing your stories.
Yeah.
It sounds like you've had a pretty interesting career, and I'm glad to see that you're continuing to serve too. It's a continual it's a trend that we have with the guests on our show. Everyone continues to give back in one way or the other. So thank you for being an inspiration.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for what you guys do too.
Absolutely.
And thanks for having me on.
And it's great to see, you know, an individual like yourself that uses their platform, their military service, to amplify a better world that we have today. So for all the ventures that you have, I wish you good luck, man. And,
appreciate
we'll,
it.
We'll certainly, be tracking you in the future.
So, are we going to get a beer now?
Bro, it's 8:30 in the morning.
Oh. 8 o'clock. Just kidding. So, 5 o'clock somewhere.
Yeah. That's right. That's
C-17 right. Pilot.
Huh? We just told you we don't drink. You know?
Oh, I forgot. Just kidding. Where's that
What's
tree?
Wrong
Where's that
with tree? You?
Yeah, right.
That's awesome. Well, thanks for coming on, man. We appreciate you. Why aren't you a pilot anymore? I didn't ask that question. I have to ask that. I'm sorry before we.
Yeah.
Do you fly anymore?
I flew a little private for a little while.
Just didn't like it.
It's the being gone and not having control of my.
Buy a personal plane. Stunt plane.
I might.
Yeah.
Honestly, when you learn to fly, you also learn how dangerous it can be if you don't stay
proficient.
Kind of proficient in.
Yeah.
In
it's flying. Not like riding a bike. Huh?
Yeah. I enjoy now sitting in the back and having a cocktail. You know,
makes sense.
I'll get up there and maybe get on the radio for fun, but you know, I don't.
You're just waiting for that moment. Is there a pilot on board?
Yeah. I do dream about saving the day all the time. I will say so.
Always say I've never done this before, but I think I've played a lot of Xbox.
For those pilots out there, I never wish harm on the guys that are flying me. But if you ever go down in the cockpit, I got you.
Yeah. Nice. Well, awesome. Thanks again for being on the show. We appreciate you, brother.